we inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio. I'm Walker Wildman here on the program. Rick Green and I, we are your host each week here on American Family Radio during the 1 o'clock Central Hour, Monday through Friday. And then we have usually a re-air or a best of, if you will, over the weekend. But it's good to be with you on today's program. This is our Friday edition of the show. And as we do each Friday, we'll have Chris Woodward in with us from American Family News, AFN.net. We'll also have a special guest here in the second segment to talk about what is going on in the Middle East, specifically in Gaza and around Israel, and what the long-term path forward is in that region as Israel begins to really finalize the war with Hamas. So we'll talk with a special gentleman in the second segment about that very subject. So we like to bring on voices and experts to bring us insight into how to view things in our culture, in our country, and in our world today. And so that's what we'll be doing this show as we try to do most episodes of the program. All right, let's turn our attention to the scripture, and then we'll jump into some of the news of the week. The scripture for the week, and we're in Proverbs chapter 2, looking at verses 6 and 7. For the Lord gives wisdom, from his mouth come knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield to those who walk in integrity. So that's verses 6 and 7 in Proverbs chapter 2. And as I've said and we've talked about, it is the Lord who brings about, who gives wisdom, who gives knowledge, who gives discretion. And without the Lord, we aren't able to have that. We aren't able to fully obtain wisdom and discernment and knowledge without the scripture. And so all of our, we've talked about our education system in America with various experts over the last few weeks. And the common theme is that the Bible needs to be a central textbook in America's education system. Why? Because that's how we get true knowledge. That's how we get true understanding. So we cannot neglect that. All right. Well, busy news week. President Trump is just hard at it. And I actually spent 3 hours at the White House this week on Tuesday getting a briefing from the White House Faith Office. And I've actually begun writing a column that's going to appear in an upcoming edition of our Stand magazine, the Stand magazine. And maybe we'll give folks a sneak peek of that article in the coming weeks. But I'm working on that now, and I put a brief statement on social media on my Facebook and X account, just talking a little bit about the meeting at the White House. So a lot of exciting things happened. It was a very productive meeting, and I think that this administration is laser-focused on the things that they campaigned on, and many of those things are protecting religious freedom, protecting the sanctity of human life, and helping marriages and families flourish. Those are some of the topics we talked about, and I'm very excited about the next 4 years. The topic I wanted to talk about, at least this segment, is the out-of-control judiciary, and that's truly what we have today. And we're going to, once again, we're going to have on Philip Draghi in the coming weeks to talk more in depth about this, and we'll link to one of Philip's latest columns on the show notes page at AFR.net on today's episode. But let's start out with a clip from the vice president. There's a lot of different angles we could take on the lawfare. President Trump is victim number one, if you will, when it comes to lawfare, and not just the raid on Mar-a-Lago, not just the multiple impeachments, but here now, under the second Trump term, we have rogue district court judges that are ruling unconstitutionally, usurping the power, the Article II power of the president, trying to basically be little presidents, And it's a problem. It's a problem for multiple reasons, of which we'll talk about. But listen to the vice president's take on who is really getting the bad end of this deal when it comes to the lawfare of the left.
Vince, there's another element of this that I don't think anybody has really picked up on, but it's really important. Like, if you think of the courts, right, to get access to the courts, let's be honest, that's mostly for, you know, people filing lawsuits. You got to have money to do that stuff. You've got to have money to hire fancy lawyers in civil suits. You know, the way that most normal people, they're not filing lawsuits when they want to accomplish something in their government. They vote. They vote for their legislators and they vote for their president. So if we allow basically a bunch of rich lawyers to run the government, but we don't allow normal people who voted for a president to see their government run the way they see fit, that I think what we're really doing is we're not just turning over the power of the government to rogue judges, we're actually depriving the American people of their God-given right to control their government. Yeah. And it's really a fundamental violation of how the American system was set up.
Yes.
We can't stand for it. We won't stand for it. We're going to keep fighting back against this stuff.
So that's the vice president on who's really getting who's really experiencing a form of injustice here, and that is the American voter. Because look, this idea, this notion that a court can one judge from one district in the U.S. can intervene and basically stop a core function of the executive branch is just patently absurd. It's patently absurd. And I would say this, even if it were a single district court judge ruling against Biden or ruling against Obama, for example. All right. So there we do have to be consistent here. But the Supreme Court is the only court in the land that was intended to have national jurisdiction, to have a national jurisdiction effect on their rulings. And even in many cases, the rulings of the Supreme Court should be limited to the parties before the court, all right, in many instances. So the point being here is that if our founding fathers knew that one district court judge in one state, in one part of that state, was issuing nationwide rulings, nationwide injunctions, hamstringing the core functions of the commander-in-chief, they would be turning over in their graves. And that's exactly what is happening here, okay? And it's one thing for a district court judge to issue some kind of preliminary injunction to the individuals before the court, the parties before the court, in a very narrow ruling, a temporary basically injunction or a temporary restraining order. That's one thing, but what we have here is a nationwide injunction with national effects. So this is going to have to be litigated to the Supreme Court. But the vice president is exactly correct here. The voters didn't send one judge to run the country. They didn't elect one judge to run the country. They elected President Donald J. Trump to run the country. And the Article II powers are overly clear. They're overtly clear, the Article II powers of the president. And there's been a couple different rulings, and we're not going to be able to talk about them all. But solely, let's talk about the ability for the president to deport illegal immigrants, okay? Illegal immigrants are not citizens, okay? They are not citizens. They do not have the full benefit to all of the due process and constitutional protections that a American citizen has. They just don't. That's part of not being a citizen, okay? And so when you enter our nation illegally, yes, you are subjected to certain parts of our judicial system, certain parts of our legal system, but you're not offered the full benefits of being an American citizen because you're not. And one of the core functions of the president is to be able to control America's immigration system, both legal and illegal. And in one of these more recent rulings, the president was deporting foreign aliens that had invaded our nation that were also associated with foreign terrorist organizations. And that function of the executive branch to protect American soil and deport a foreign terrorist is a non-controversial, traditionally unchallenged role of the president. Biden did this frequently, not as much as he should have, all right? But these are functions that every president has carried out. So it's not that President Trump's showing up to town and he's all of a sudden exerting these newfound powers of the presidency. Deporting illegal immigrants happens every day and has been happening every day under multiple presidents dating back hundreds of years. And all of a sudden, a district court judge wants to weigh in and say, well, the president doesn't really have this authority. Or the president has this authority, but it's going to be according to what I say the authority that he has and the limits that I say that he has. Do you see the problem here? And what's so frustrating and is blatantly political is that the White House released a statistic this week that is unfathomable. I read the statistic. I didn't quite believe it, but it's legit. And that is that over 90% of the nationwide injunctions have been issued against Donald J. Trump. Over 90% of the nationwide injunctions in recent years, if not over the last few decades, have been issued against President Trump. And so my point in bringing that up is that this has not been something that has been happening over centuries, and nationwide injunctions have always been a thing, and they've been issued against former presidents, including Democrats, and this is just part of the part of politics. That's just not the case. This nationwide injunction tool is clearly being weaponized against one person, one president, and that is Donald J. Trump. And now let's shift to the Supreme Court, all right? Because I can complain all day long about one district court judge out of hundreds, but let's talk about the Supreme Court. All right, the role of the Supreme Court, one of the roles of the Supreme Court, is when these lower courts are blatantly wrong, blatantly unconstitutional, the role of the Supreme Court is to slap them down, to put them back in their place. And the Supreme Court has utterly failed on this front. The Supreme Court, under Chief Justice John Roberts, has profusely allowed these lower district court judges to reign supreme and to throw around nationwide injunctions completely unchecked. Also, let's talk about the Senate for a minute. Because after all of these judges were approved by the Senate per the Constitution through the advise and consent role. And I know when we talk about turning down and voting down presidential appointments, specifically judges, everybody gets very squishy here. Oh, we can't do that. The Senate must sign off on judicial nominations. But I think we really need to rethink this. Because what has happened here is not only has the Supreme Court refused to step in and slap down these lower courts, but the Senate, they're the ones that have approved these terrible, terrible judicial nominations. These rogue, Marxist, unconstitutional judges were approved by our very own U.S. Senate through the advising consent role. So to me, that's a problem as well. And then lastly, Congress has the power to deconstruct the judiciary at their discretion. We'll be back in a few.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to The Core here on American Family Radio. If you would like to subscribe to the podcast, you can do so by simply typing in the name of the show and clicking the subscribe button. Type in At the Core, find this program in your podcast library, and click the subscribe button. And the show will be queued up in your library each and every day. Well, I do want to jump to our next guest to maximize our time for this segment. Joseph Browdy is with us now. He's president and founder of the Center for Peace Communications. And Joseph's on with us now to talk about what is going on in Israel, in the Middle East, and the path forward for Israel and Gaza. Joseph, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Well, Joseph, before we get kind of in the nuts and the bolts and the more intricate details of how Israel and Gaza should move forward after this war, tell us a little bit about your background and really how long you've been focused on all things Middle East.
I've been active in the Middle East for all of my professional life, 32 years now, traveling throughout the region, Arab countries, Iran and Israel, and I lead the Center for Peace Communications, which is focused on amplifying the voices of people in the region who live under the rule of these terror militias, Hamas, Hezbollah, and other groups, and want a different future. And those are the voices that are silenced by the terror organizations and who really need to be heard. And that's what we do at the Center for Peace Communications.
Yeah, this is very good that we're talking about this. And I will say it is hard to find people to interview that are knowledgeable in the subject. So it's good to have you on. I recently traveled to Israel, and one thing I noticed, and that's something you've alluded to in one of your recent articles that I read, is that the Hamas-Israel conflict. It's hard to tell what people on the ground there feel. Specifically, I'm talking about Arabs and those in Gaza. Like, do they all sympathize with Hamas? Do some of them disagree with Hamas? It's really hard to get a feel for it this far away because we're not on the ground, right? So we're just getting whatever the media says or whatever Hamas spokespersons say. But give us kind of your understanding of what's the ideological breakdown, for example, in Gaza, amongst the Palestinians. What's the ideological breakdown as far as people who support Hamas, those who don't, those who want to be liberated? Talk about that a little bit.
So opposition to Hamas has been growing over many years. They've been in power for a generation, and they portray themselves to the outside world as a resistance organization. But what they really are is a dictatorship that rules with an iron fist in Gaza. And in 2019, about 1,000 young people, which is a lot for the Gaza Strip, took to the streets and waged anti-Hamas street demonstrations, braving gunfire and prison. They did it again in July 30th of 2023, a few months before October 7th. their families were punished collectively for what they did. So obviously for the 1,000 who were brave enough to do that, there's a very large number who feel the way they do, but didn't have the courage to do the same thing. So opposition to Hamas in Gaza today is at an all-time high. They blame Hamas for their suffering. They know that Hamas waged the October 7th attacks and in doing so triggered the response that has been so destructive, this destructive war. Which has wrecked homes and infrastructure and so on, because Hamas embeds itself in civilian infrastructure and actually wants to trigger these types of casualties so they can win a political war through media and disinformation. Now, the fact that a lot of Gazans are virulently opposed to Hamas does not make them pro-Israel per se. In other words, they may agree with Hamas about its goals, or more generally feel that all of Palestine from the river to the sea belongs to them. Nonetheless, they are, a lot of them are pragmatic enough to understand that some kind of partnership with Israel to rebuild the Strip is necessary, and they would go along with it. At the same time, there's also about 15 to 20% of the population that genuinely believes in coexistence with Israel. Hmm. So it's a range, but one thing that I can tell you for sure is that opposition to Hamas is at an all-time high in Gaza.
Yeah, that's good to know. I haven't heard it put that way, but that's good to know. Let me ask you this about, I think that the entire terminology and traditional two-state solution discussion, I think at this point is proven that that's just not going to work. Looking at it through that old lens is just not going to work because they've been talking about this for decades. But as far as the Jews, and let's just say the Arabs or the Gazans, and that, I know the term Arab is overly broad, but many of the people in Gaza are Arabs, and that this conflict is rooted in decades, well, longer than that, centuries worth of history that we don't have time to go over. But my point is that Jews and Arabs have lived together. And let's just take Israel, modern day Israel, when you look at including the West Bank, which I've been to, them living together, not complete, it's not perfect, and it's not perfectly peaceful. There's incidents, but it's largely peaceful and civilized, where the Palestinian Authority kind of controls law enforcement in the West Bank. The IDF has you know, national security rights into the West Bank to run terror operations, etc. But my point is that I don't know why something like that can't happen in Gaza, where you have Israeli security control, but then you have maybe Palestinian Authority control as far as day-to-day police work. Why is that not being discussed, or maybe it is being discussed?
Well, I think that there's widespread agreement, certainly in Israel, also the Trump administration, and many well-meaning people around the world understand that you can't go back to October 6th. You can't have Hamas in power in Gaza. And you also can't have it in a situation like Hezbollah in Lebanon, where there's a nominal government or administration, whereas while Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Gaza remains heavily armed and in a position to dominate politics, even if it's not in charge of day-to-day administration. So there's no viable civil administration in Gaza as long as Hamas is there and armed.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. Now, the second concern that a lot of Israelis are bringing to discussions of post-war Gaza is that the Palestinian Authority and Hamas, while they may disagree on many things, are inculcating a fundamentally similar ideological view about Israel. That is, they're both teaching in their schools, through their mosques, and through their media as well, the idea that the Jewish state is not legitimate.
Yeah.
And it's not long for this earth. And so they are ideological first cousins. And that's what leads people in Israel to say, is there a way to form a new administration of young Gazans who want a different path? And there is thinking along those lines. Some people are pushing for it. The possibility, meanwhile, also exists that President Trump's ideas about some portion of Gazans migrating to neighboring countries, at least as an interim measure, while the Strip is a wreck. And it's dangerous, and their presence there only serves the interest of Hamas as human shields, that may be part of the answer as well, that the Egyptian border could open and open up to Gazans who are looking for safe haven elsewhere in the Middle East.
Yeah, I completely agree with your assessment of Hamas and the Palestinian Authority and the problems there, because the West Bank has its own issues when it comes to radical Islam, which is why the IDF has to go in there, it seems like, every other day. Let me mention the post-war Gaza that you've written about and you just alluded to. Why does Egypt and others, maybe Jordan, Saudi Arabia, why are they so hesitant, at least from what we read in the public reporting, to take people from Gaza, specifically women and children? I mean, why are they, these are fellow Muslim, these are Muslim majority nations. They're not, of course, they're not aligned with Iran by any circumstance, or actually in the Abraham Accords. Why are they resistant? What's the issue with them at least temporarily taking Gazans in?
Yeah, it's perplexing, isn't it? Because they profess to champion the Palestinian cause. They profess solidarity with Palestinians. But when it comes to the people themselves, as opposed to some notion of the cause that is about an unending struggle against the Jewish state, they suddenly view these people in a different way. In fact, countries that took in Syrian refugees, Iraqi refugees in the prior war, are somehow unwilling. Now, part of that stems from some bitter history in Jordan and Lebanon, where Palestinians entered the country and created different types of civil unrest. Now, the difference is that those were incidents in which the governments allowed those Palestinians to be armed and to wage cross-border raids against Israel. And of course, over time, they turned their arms on their hosts in those countries and became a serious security problem. Now, there is no reason to assume that that would happen again. Certainly no one is talking about, no one should be talking about allowing Palestinian armed groups to function in Egypt or Jordan.
Right.
But you're talking about civilians who were motivated by the same desire for safe haven that has caused millions of Syrian and Ukrainian civilians to flee war in their countries. And so I think that this notion of Palestinian exceptionalism is what has to be confronted. These are ordinary people with the same human needs and aspirations of any people on earth.
What about the Trump plan? Let's just call it that. That seemed crazy looking at it at first glance, and maybe parts of it is crazy. Or maybe overly aspirational, let's put it that way. As far as rebuilding Gaza, some have mentioned like rebuilding into partially kind of a Mediterranean resort type strip. I think that's overly aspirational. That would be great if you could, but returning Gazans back in, let's say that the Gaza Strip is rebuilt, whatever that looks like, why can Israel not just control it? And when I say control it, that may mean different things, but why can't it just be Israeli territory, and then the Gazans, who are not Hamas affiliated and who don't ideologically align with Hamas, move back in and live under it, under Israeli security, and that seals up the Philadelphia corridor and prevents, you know, the obviously zero Hamas control back. Why can't Israel just control it for the future?
Well, I think that Israel, after October 7th, will demand a measure of control of certainly matters that relate to security in the Strip, because they don't want to ever allow the kind of development that led to October 7th to happen again. As far as the Gazan population centers of Palestinians in Gaza, the concern has to do with radicalization or maintaining the radical inculcation that has dominated Gaza for over a generation. There would need to be a comprehensive plan to de-radicalize schools, media, and mosques in the Gaza Strip for the sake of the next generation. And by the way, the first victims of those campaigns of radicalization have been the Gazans themselves. They're denied the basic tools of critical thinking and rational deliberation that we get in school. And having been denied that, it makes them vulnerable to manipulation by extremist groups before you even get into what the ideas are that those extremists are promulgating. So there needs to be a campaign of de-radicalization. Israel will understandably insist on security in the Gaza Strip and its own seat at the table in that effort to secure the Strip. And there may be multiple visions, and they don't necessarily have to conflict with one another. There have been interesting conversations about piloting self-rule in portions of Gaza. You might try something in one part of the Strip. You might try something else in another part of the Strip. And people may vote with their feet in terms of ending up where they believe their best future is. And again, some number of Gazans who want to emigrate should have the same opportunity to find safe haven elsewhere that has been granted to Ukrainians, Syrians, and basically everyone else on the planet who faced war and destruction in their home country.
Yeah. Well, this has been a very interesting conversation. We've been talking to Joseph Browdy, president, founder of Center for Peace Communications. Hey, Joseph, before we go, 15 seconds left, tell our folks what your URL is.
Peacecomms.org. That's MMS.
All right. Excellent, Joseph. Hey, thanks so much for coming on the program.
My pleasure.
All right. That's Joseph Browdy, president, founder, Center for Peace Communications, talking about Gaza, the future with Israel there after the war. We'll be back in a few minutes.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the program. Walker Wildman here. This is our Friday edition of the show. Well, before we jump to Chris, I do want to remind you of a couple things. We have three AFA events coming up over the next several months. The first one being in June of this year, June 12th through the 14th, is our Activate Summit, first ever Activate Summit. That's going to be an exciting time, two-day summit here in the city of our national headquarters. Go to afa.net/events for that event and all the events for the year, afa.net/events, and you can register there, find out all the information you need. And then secondly and lastly, is our spiritual heritage tours for the year. We go to Washington, Williamsburg, Boston, and Israel, and then Greece, Footsteps of Paul. So both Boston and Footsteps of Paul are two brand new tours. Boston's going to take place in October of this year. Footsteps of Paul is going to take place in March of 26. But registration is available for all of those trips now over at wildmangroup.com. wildmangroup.com, and we explore much of America's early Christian heritage, and also, of course, the footsteps of Paul in Israel are fascinating when you're looking at biblical history. So a lot of good stuff there. You can go over to wildmangroup.com to check out more information. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Well, Chris, as described by the White House, the dismantling of the Department of Education has effectively begun as of this week.
Yes.
And President Trump on Thursday signed an executive order outlining his desire to dismantle the Department of Education.
And it was kind of a unique event in that it wasn't just him sitting in the Oval Office signing the order and talking to the camera, talking to reporters. He did it in front of kids sitting in school desks. It was a very interesting optic where he talked about how it was important for these kids to get the best education, and the best education possible in President Trump's mind is to hand the issue of education education back to the states, which is what it was done before you and I were born. There was a time in America, even though liberals want you to believe that the Department of Education has been around as long as the Marines and the Postal Service, it's only been since 1979, 1980. So baby boomers grew up in a world and, you know, put a man on the moon and did all these things without the federal Department of Education. And I think they did just fine. And now Trump wants to return us to that era. But as you are well aware, Walker, there are going to be lawsuits. A federal judge at some point is going to, you know, start weighing in, several federal judges, I should say.
Yeah.
So we'll have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, they're going to, mark my word, they're going to try to act like they're the president. Mm-hmm. This is what's happening. I mean, this is the only tool the left has, other than domestic terrorism, which they're currently engaged in, which maybe we'll have time to talk about. This is a pivotal moment for the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court, on multiple fronts, is going to have to reestablish constitutional authority of the president and strike down these lower courts. I mean, this is their opportunity. And if they miss it, it will be a stain on this country. Let me play a clip here, Chris. This is Caroline Leavitt talking about how the Department of Education has effectively educated zero children.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not an exaggeration. And how they've spent $3 trillion and our education has worsened. Let's listen.
President Trump is not failing America's children. He is saving America's children with this action that he will take later today, directing Linda McMahon, our great Secretary of Education, to dismantle this federal bureaucracy that has taken more than $3 trillion from the American taxpayer since its inception in 1979. And what have we had as a result of that investment in our children's education? Declining test scores in reading, writing, and math. Proficiency levels at record lows for eighth graders, for fourth graders, at every level in every state across this country. That's why the president is returning education back to the people, to those closest to our students in our classrooms, and that is teachers and educators and parents who know what is best for their children. And we are excited about this event that will be here later in the afternoon at the White House. We will have parents and educators and students and also governors from across the country who are excited to embrace this new responsibility of educating our nation's children. I will add one more point. The Department of Education has never educated a child. All it has ever done is stolen money from the taxpayers for more regulation that has hurt our children's education. And it's about time a president does something about it. And thank God President Trump is.
All right. Well, that was Caroline Leavitt, White House spokesperson, on the failure, really, of the Department of Education. Chris, I want to set the expectations with our listening audience because I don't want them to be misled. The president doesn't have the authority to shut down, to de facto shut down an agency that is congressionally authorized.
Mm-hmm.
Now there is a clear case that many of the agencies that exist today are unconstitutional because they are not constitutionally established. All right, so I understand and agree with that argument, and Rick Green talks about this often. But the fact of the matter is today is that Congress has established agencies through the president, because he signed the legislation, established these agencies. And unless there's a case before the Supreme Court where you bring into question the legitimacy of the agencies, right now the president can't, with a stroke of a pen, literally shut down the Department of Education.
Mm-hmm.
But what he does have the authority to do is hire and fire and dictate the future of the agency and how many employees they have and the way they function internally. And that's what he's doing with this order.
Mm-hmm.
He is largely downsizing the agency and making it to where basically they're handling student loans and block grants.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, AFN.net has posted information that summarizes what Walker just shared. He's not the only one to say as much. Gary Bauer of American Values told us as much on today's issues yesterday, talking about how basically it's just a department that sucks in billions of dollars and does nothing with it. Moms for Liberty, our Bronson Woodruff talked to Tiffany Justice at Moms for Liberty about the idea of getting rid of the Department of Education. She was a fan of that as well, saying that we are spending more and more money every year and getting poorer results for it. We spend more on education than many countries, some countries combined, and we're doing poorly. Every year that I've worked here for 15 years, we've done stories on what's called the nation's report card, and the last few nation's report cards have found that kids in fourth and eighth grade are behind in areas like math and reading. And that's after the Biden administration and others have called for and actually pumped more and more money into education. And it was a problem a long time ago, which is why people like President Reagan back in, I think it was 82, called for the dismantling of education. That was before it really got going. Yeah. He didn't like the idea, but he didn't have the public support at the time.
Yeah. Another thing President Trump needs to look into, and hopefully with this order or with Linda McMahon at the helm of the Department of Education, The entire student loan process needs to be looked at because it has enabled these universities to up rates, their tuition rates, astronomically to where – but and the reason they've been able to do it is because the federal government keeps agreeing to pay these astronomical tuitions instead of negotiating lower tuition rates.
Yes.
So that needs to be looked into as well. It's a really big scandal. And it has a lot of ethical and legal questions behind it because you're effectively creating somewhat of a Ponzi scheme where the feds are subsidizing the universities at a scale that's very unhealthy and is not in the best interest of our national debt and are in the best interest of these students, because at the end of the day, the students end up footing the bill.
Yes, government
for student loans.
I mean, government is largely responsible, if not solely responsible for the problem in college education. They've not done anything, and this is really going back several administrations, but they haven't done anything to where they forced colleges to really look at what they're charging and find ways to charge less. They just, you know, as and people have told me for a long time now, as long as Uncle Sam is always there with a checkbook, a college will have no problem driving up tuition because they know they're going to get it from the federal government. And then those people are going to get, some of them, are going to get a, you know, a master's degree in basket weaving with a emphasis in Aramaic.
Yeah.
And then they have, like, no skills whatsoever in the workforce to make any money.
Yeah, and for those listening telling me it's not a Ponzi scheme, I get it. It's not literally a Ponzi scheme, but it's financially fraudulent is my point. It's a financially fraudulent and questionable legal framework where there's zero accountability.
Yes.
The federal government says, yeah, we'll back this student's loan regardless of what their projected income is after they graduate from college. And then they, at the end of the day, it's not the federal government that pays the bill or the university, it's the student.
Yes.
That's like a 17 years old signing up for a $300,000 student loan.
Yes.
And then they graduate and they're like, yeah, I don't even remember when I signed this. So I've got to pay at this point with interest $400,000 back. And then so they're left with the bill.
Yeah.
And it's a major, major problem.
And meanwhile, many universities are sitting on like million and billion dollar endowments. It's not like they don't have the cash to put towards lowering the cost of education. And one of the other things, too, if you don't mind, government also makes it a problem because, you know, I know when I graduated high school and went to college, I ended up in the first couple of years having to take many of the same courses I was required to pass in high school to go to college.
Yeah, I've got two words for you. Education advisor.
Yes.
Or advisor. That's a problem as well, where you have these advisors, and we've all heard the horror stories, where the advisors tell you wrongly about what courses you should take, and you don't find out about it until your senior year.
Yes, yeah, that botany class is really paying off for mine.
You spend 5 years instead of four. But Chris, I think there's a large move afoot that's raising the valid question about how valuable college is to begin with.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And look, I get it. Your specialized, you know, degrees, your lawyers, your doctors, and your engineers, some of those fields, they need to put some time in, right, getting an education. But a lot of these fields can probably get by with a two-year education, an associate's degree.
Oh, sure. No doubt. And, you know, a lot of times, too, it's not where you went to college. It's the amount of work you put into it and how much networking you're doing.
That's right.
And also, too, if you're a young person listening to the sound of my voice, First of all, thank you for listening to Walker's show.
Papa Chris.
Yes.
Papa Chris. Here
you
go.
So here, if you are not sure about college, you're not really sure about a degree, but maybe you've got some skills in the area of trades or whatnot,
yeah.
Kind of look into going to a vocational school and really kind of learning more trade skills.
Yeah.
Because here's the thing. Social media influencers also have to eat. They have to live somewhere. They have to go to the bathroom.
Yes.
So there's nothing wrong in 2025 with knowing things about welding, electricity, and digging a ditch.
Yes. That's a good point, Chris. And I think in this high-tech environment that we're living in, with AI coming on the scene, I think the manual trades are going to be very valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're going to become a very popular space because of job security reasons. Let's talk about the housing, because you and I like to talk about the stock market and jobs, and housing numbers are looking better. They've been on a slump. They've been on basically a standstill over the last few months.
Yes.
Because of pricing and interest rates. But the market's moving again.
It is. And this may be two of the most exciting numbers this week. Existing home sales, for those not aware, existing home sales came in at 4.26 million in February. The expectation from groups like MarketWatch was for under 4 million. So far beat expectations there with 4.26 million. Meanwhile, building permits were up, also beating expectations. That means existing properties are becoming new homes for people, and people that need places to live, those things are starting to be built. We are assuming these things will only pick up through the coming months because the weather is going to be nicer.
Yeah.
And things are presumably going to be cheaper due to things like energy being more available.
Yeah. I think that is largely driven for two reasons. I'm talking about the uptick in home sales.
Mm-hmm.
The interest rates have come down nearly a percentage point. Nearly 100 basis points since President Trump was sworn in, which is phenomenal. You're talking about 8 weeks, 7 weeks. And also, I would say consumer confidence. I know if you look at the numbers out there, there's a consumer confidence is down. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. We've been beaten by Biden's economy for 4 years, and Trump gets in there, one of the best economic presidents in modern history, and you want to tell me consumer confidence is down? Are you kidding me? I don't believe that under any circumstance. I personally think home buyers felt a little bit of confidence with Trump coming in, with projecting lower interest rates down the road. But home prices have not come down to pre-pandemic numbers by any means. Yeah. But Chris, they have come down some.
Yes. Yeah. And a lot of organizations, think tanks, are pushing for things like permitting reform to allow for more single family units, multifamily housing to introduce and make more places available
more
for people to live.
Yeah. Inventory has been a problem for some time. I almost get tired of hearing real estate agents talk about low inventory. It's like, y'all been talking about low inventory since I was born. Can we not fix the low inventory problem, guys? But maybe this will happen over the next few years. But you've got to have deregulation, to Chris's point. You've got to have low affordable interest rates. You've got to have comparable, sane home values, not these astronomical overvalued homes. A lot at play there, but President Trump is working day and night to get it done. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
All right, folks, check out American Family News, AFN.net. We'll see you next time. Meet Kelsey. When she found out she was pregnant, she wasn't sure where to turn. But after meeting with the counselors at a preborn network clinic who loved and supported her, and after hearing her baby's heartbeat on a free ultrasound, she chose Life.
When a mother looks at her child through a sonogram, it does something to you. You know, I ended up deciding to keep my son, who is now 5 years old today. He's amazing. He brings absolute joy to my heart. I could not imagine life without him. Not only did they help me save his life, they saved my life.
By introducing a woman to her baby on ultrasound, a baby's chance of life doubles. If you have the means, would you consider a leadership gift to save babies in a big way? Your tax-deductible donation of $5,000 will sponsor Preborn's entire network for 24 hours, helping to rescue 200 babies. to donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 on your phone and then say the keyword baby. Or you can donate securely at preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.